Yes, so the last talk, I think I said last week's was the penultimate, so this is the ultimate. I don't mean that in any boasting way, of course, because that would contravene the mind training. Ultimate in the sense of last, the last in the series. And yes, it's been quite a long journey through a lot of material. I've really enjoyed being here and giving the talks. It's given my life a very strong focus in the last couple of months, and it's a text I know quite well, but you know, to give a series of talks, to think about it again, to think about how to communicate it, it's relevant, do justice to the text, has all kind of helped me relate to that text more strongly, so thank you very much. I hope you found it helpful in your life and practice. So before I go into the seventh point, the precepts of mind training, I'd like to dedicate the series of talks, including this one. And I know that often one does that at the beginning of something, beginning of a book, but it's felt more appropriate to me to do it at this point. So I'd like to dedicate the talk, first of all, to the great teacher Atisha, whose text we've been studying. So he was a great Indian teacher. He's on our refuge tree. He was so enthused about going for refuge that he was sometimes called the refuge guru, which I think is why he's a favourite of Bhante's. He was said to be always in communication, sort of a direct communication with his yidam, Green Tara. He asked Tara for advice, and she was there. She talked to him, as it were. And he spent the last 13 years of his life in Tibet. He was a great Indian teacher. He was said to be a recipient of all three lineages of the Dharma that were present at that time. So a great teacher in India. And then he was asked to go to Tibet and spent 13 years there. And he's said to be responsible for the second diffusion of the Dharma in Tibet after a period of great persecution. So, yeah, very important teacher. He started off practicing Vajrayana, and then he decided to study the earlier texts, the Pali texts, in their Sanskrit translations. And then he decided he really needed a set of practices to develop bodhicitta. So he went on this long sea journey. It's said to have been 13 months on a long sea journey to the island of Sumatra to meet his teacher Dharmakirti. So with Dharmakirti he stayed and practiced for 12 years studying the mind training. And apparently Dharmakirti constantly asked Atisha while Atisha was studying with him, is the bodhicitta in you? Is it blended with all your actions? Is the mind of wisdom and compassion in all your thoughts? Is emptiness and compassion in all that you do? So this was a kind of constant question. And because Atisha, I think, realised bodhicitta through training with Dharmakirti, he always revered him and would always bring his hands together in salutation if Dharmakirti's name was mentioned, saying, whatever little of the good heart I may possess is due to the kindness of this teacher. So Atisha is very, very important in the mind training tradition, and we have used his text, so I like to dedicate these talks to him, without whom they would not have been possible. And secondly, to Chikawa. Chikawa is the author of the other texts that we've been studying. So he's a little bit later. He's 12th century. Atisha was 10th, 11th century. And he's a Tibetan. So we talked, I mean, I mentioned these people in the first talks, but I'd like to come back to them. So he had done all sorts of practices, all sorts of teachings. But he was still searching, still seeking. And he heard this verse from Langra Tangpa's eight verses. He heard the verse that says, when others out of jealousy treat me badly with abuse, slander and so on, I will learn to take on all loss and offer victory to them. So that's a mind training verse. He was so struck by that that he thought, I've got to find the author of that text. Unfortunately, Langra Tangpa was dead, but he found one of his disciples, Sharawa, and he studied with him for 12 years. It seems you have to study and practice the mind training for at least 12 years. So yes, he studied and practiced with Sharawa. And Chikawa's great gift to the Dharma is that he made the teachings publicly known and taught them very widely. Before that, it had been an oral, almost secret tradition. If you remember, Atisha said, the mind training was very easy to explain, but very hard to put into practice. So it was a kind of secret oral teaching for a long time. But Chikawa, he took Atisha's teaching and expanded it into these 57, 59 pithy aphorisms, and he taught it widely, and so he's a great mind training teacher. And lastly, I'd like to dedicate the talks to my own teacher, Ergin Sangharakshita, my teacher, my preceptor, my friend, from whom I was taught Bodhisattva ideal, the Bodhisattva ideal, but whom, in a way, I caught it from Bodhisattva, from Bhante, if you like. So one can teach, one can be taught, one can catch. Sometimes it's better to be taught, to be caught, not taught, sorry. So yes, I'd like to dedicate these talks to him. So the Bodhisattva ideal, which I can caught from him and which he also taught, has been a guiding inspiration in my own teaching, in my own spiritual practice and life. And I've always been very struck by the fact that Bhante founded the order and the movement with the ideal that us ordinary folks, us people, working intensively together and in harmony, which is not that easy, as you know. But if we did that, we could be a reflection of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. So I think that's a very wonderful ideal. It's always inspired me. So yes, I've always been inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal. In a way, in its more kind of magic, mythical, symbolic, you know, those wonderful Mahayana sutras with millions of beings and millions of universes and intersecting light beams, and you know, I love all that stuff. So the mind training teachings are, you know, they're part of the Mahayana tradition, but they're a little bit different from that, aren't they? So I came across the mind training, the 7-point mind training and the 8 verses. I can't remember when it was. It's probably about 7 or 8 years ago. And I discovered them at a time when, you know, I had some challenges in my own life. One challenge was I was asked to be a public preceptor, which is a huge leap in responsibility. That was great. I thought, yes, I'll do that. But at the same time, my mother, who was very old and lived alone and wasn't very well, got very sick. So I needed to try and do both those things, try and somehow embrace both those things. So it was quite a stretch. And I had to dig quite deep to find the resources. But one of the main difficulties in that period was that I came into close contact again with my brother. And he and I do not have an easy relationship. Of course, I'm very, very grateful to him because he gives me so much difficulty. He is a wish-fulfilling gem in my life. Of course he is. but it was very challenging and very difficult. My mum and me and him all under the same tiny roof, like back like when we were, you know, children together, very, very, not very easy. And I came across the mind training teachings, and I just thought, oh, this is just so kind of useful, even to just have it in the back of your mind, you know, that he could be a wish-fulfilling gem, for me was very helpful. So the 7-point mind training and the 8 verses, yeah, I discovered about that time. And I suppose it's the emphasis in taking hardships onto the path, taking adversity onto the path, which really struck me. And compared with that wonderful kind of magic, mythical, symbolic aspect of the Bodhisattva ideal, the mind training, although they're grounded in that, are very, very practical, aren't they? They kind of tell you how it is. They tell you what you like and what you might be able to do about it. And they just kind of reveal, you know, that we do fall into desires for revenge and blame and retaliation and how that's not a great idea and, you know, how to work with that. So very, very practical. So I found that very, very helpful. So I hope that you have found the mind training helpful also. So on to the last point, the precepts of the mind training. So I said last week I wasn't really sure how the 21 precepts differed from the 16 commitments of point six, and I'm still not entirely sure. They seem to me to be quite similar and to overlap in some ways. But some commentators say that the last week's 16 commitments or pledges are more associated with the perfection of wisdom. They're about kind of cutting through, seeing what your mental states are like, cutting through and trying to undermine ego clinging. And that the precepts, which we're about to come on to, are more to do with furthering our practice in relationship with others in daily life, in what's called, in the Tibetan tradition, post-meditation. Anyway, they seem to be quite similar to me. I thought perhaps this is Chikawa's last chance to drive home to us what it is we really need to do and practice, and it doesn't really matter if they're a repetition of what's gone before. So, precepts. And I talked last week about the precepts, precepts being related to going for refuge in our own tradition, and that Sangharakshita talks about going for refuge being that primary, existential, radical, most important deep experience, which is then expressed in daily life in precepts. And it's the same with the mind training. So the mind training touches into bodhicitta and then those are maintained and developed, that experience is maintained and developed through the practice of precepts. And I think we need both an inner and outer experience. So if going for refuge in bodhicitta, if that's the kind of inner, existential, crucial, most meaningful experience, and then that's expressed in precepts, and you have both. You have inner and outer balance. You have wisdom and compassion, vision and transformation. And I suppose sometimes they can get divorced from one another. If you lose touch with your inner experience, with what really motivates you, what's really meaningful, it may be that you carry on practicing precepts, but those precepts become more like rules because they're not connected with your inspiration or your aspiration. So they become more moralistic or judgmental. You tend to do the right thing, go through the motions. So you need both. On the other hand, sometimes we get so excited by our inner experience and our touching into the mystery, as it were. Maybe that is for a moment, but then we kind of think we're there, as it were, and we think we don't need to bother about ethics and precepts. Sometimes that happens. So again, the inner and the outer experience have become divorced. So we need both. We need the inner and the outer conjoined. We need principle and practice. We need vision and transformation, wisdom and compassion. And there's a saying in Tibetan Buddhism, it may be Padmasambhava, I can't quite remember, which says, descend with the view and ascend with the conduct. So the view is the vision, the view is the mystery. So the idea that you bring that into your daily life, you descend with the view and you ascend with the conduct. So your ethical practice takes you, as it were, back into relationship with that vision. And Padmasambhava did say, my view is as high as the sky. So, you know, very panoramic, open-ended, limitless view in the positive sense. I think he said something like, but my conduct is as fine as flour. I sift my conduct as fine as flour. So again, you have that very expansive vision and you have the very fine detail to ethical practice. So this is the territory we're in, and we're expressing bodhicitta in a number of precepts in order to help us develop and maintain that experience. So in the teacher's verse, in his seventh verse, he says, in essence, by the gracious Lama's blessings, may I genuinely train my mind according to all the precepts which further the two aspects of bodhicitta and attain realization of the supreme vehicle within this very lifetime. So that's his aspiration. And then Chikawa takes that verse and actually lists 21 precepts. So many of them repeat what's already been said, and in a way I suppose that's their purpose, is to just kind of remind us of what it is that we're trying to do in the mind training. So the first five, I think, tend to hang together, and they do relate back to things that we've already practiced, already mentioned. So number one, in all your activities, have a single purpose. All active meditation is done in one way. So this is very similar to, if you remember back along, all dharmas have one purpose. So with that aphorism, all dharmas have one purpose. Whatever the teaching is, it has one purpose, and that is to uproot ego clinging or selfishness. So this is in all your activities, in all active meditation. This is very much to do with being in life, as it were, are to be done in one way or have a single purpose. And that purpose is, again, to uproot ego clinging and to train in the two bodhicittas. So this is more practice orientated. We're so concerned with post-meditation. We're concerned with all the activities of daily life, walking, sitting, lying down, etc., etc. There's one aim in all those activities, everything you do, and that's to develop loving kindness, to benefit others. So whether you're doing the mindfulness of breathing, whether you're engaged in right livelihood, in work, in friendship, whatever the practice you're engaged in, this text says that's all there to help you develop bodhicitta. So I think if you think that all your activities have a single purpose, again, then everything hangs together. Everything has the same meaning, purpose, effect. There's no breaks in your practice. It's very strong in the mind training. There's no breaks in practice, no nothing, no obstacles that get in the way. Everything that you do can be done with this purpose of developing bodhicitta. So it's as if, to use an image that we're quite familiar with, it's as if bodhicitta and going for refuge are right at the centre of our mandala. So everything is informed by that. So keep this purpose in mind, set your intention. And I think it's interesting in Tibetan tradition that when the Tibetans talk about mindfulness, they do mean mindfulness in the way we mean mindfulness, mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of body, mindfulness of emotions, mindfulness of thoughts, but they also mean very strongly mindfulness of bodhicitta, to never forget bodhicitta, because it's so crucial. So in all your activities, have a single purpose. So you can see how that would lead to a very integrated experience of life, practice, activities. Number two, to correct all wrongs with one intention, or all corrections are made in one way. So I suppose to correct all wrongs with one intention means, again, to develop bodhicitta. All corrections are made in one way. This means that you practice tonglen. So whatever's happening, if you're struggling, if you find the mind training challenging, if you feel you're not doing very well with it, if whatever practice you've taken up, sometimes it seems as though life gets more difficult rather than easier to begin with, you can take all that onto the path. You can respond with tonglen, taking and sending. So every experience, whatever it is, can be used to connect with yourself and others with empathy. It's the same, isn't it, with the metta bhavana. In the metta bhavana is a response, is a creative response to whatever condition you find yourself, and you can always respond with metta to whatever you're feeling. Same principle. So number three, renew your commitments when you get up and before you go to sleep. So this is interesting. This is very practical, isn't it? Very simple. It's very easy for us to just lose awareness, isn't it, of what it is we're trying to do. We just get so distracted so easily, so busy, so forgetful. It's very hard to keep up our momentum. And to apply those five powers, the power of intention, that intensity, that wholeheartedness, and the other powers. So this just says, well, first thing in the morning, as soon as you open your eyes, just remember what it is that you want to do with your day. You know, some verse, some thought, some, you know, a mantra, something very, can be very, very simple. You could just, if you remembered Tsongkhapa's poem, you could just recite that before you have a cup of coffee, before you do whatever. You know, you just kind of remember, set your intention, as it were. So you call to mind your purpose first thing in the morning and last thing at night before you go to sleep. You look back over the day and you evaluate how that's gone. If it's gone well, that's great. Be joyful, be happy, and dedicate the merits to all sentient beings. If it hasn't gone well, you think, well, what happened? You know, what went wrong? Could I do better? You know, what were the conditions that brought that about, in a very kind way? And you can confess to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas if you're on your own. You can breathe that in. So you can do tonglen again. You can breathe in any difficulties and breathe out loving kindness. So you're kind of framing your day with that kind of intention and that kind of evaluation at the end. So very, very simple, but very positive, if we can remember to do it. Sometimes these things you remember for a while, don't you? And then, you know, about a month later, you think, oh, I was doing that every day for a while. What happened to that? You know, say you start again. You just start again with that intention. And I think this is quite simple, that it's first thing in the morning, last thing at night. In some texts, in the Bodhisattva precepts, it says, worship the three jewels three times a day. And in the Sangha's text on the Bodhisattva ideal, it says six times throughout the day and night. So in a way, this is quite simple, isn't it? Just first thing in the morning, last thing at night. Something that sets your purpose, something that allows you to evaluate. Number four, accept good and bad fortune with an equal mind. So you're trying to develop equanimity and patience. And I think we've talked quite a lot about equanimity and patience through our looking at the texts. So if you experience pain or suffering or unhappiness, whatever of whatever kind, practice tonglen for yourself. Just kind of breathe that in and realize that so many other people experience that kind of pain. So you kind of accept and acknowledge the pain that you feel, but you also realize it's not just you. You don't kind of hold it to yourself. You just allow yourself to realise, yeah, that other people feel exactly that kind of pain. Other people are disappointed. Other people are brokenhearted. Other people have lost something. And that kind of opens you out. It just opens your heart. And also then you won't fall into depression, hopefully. So you can also reflect that any kind of suffering or pain is a karmic effect of living in conditioned existence. It's not that all pain is a result of karma. Karma is intended action, intentional action, and pain arises through all kinds of reasons. You're here in conditioned existence, you've been born in conditioned existence, you're not enlightened. So in a way, that is a karmic effect, that's a vipaka, you're here. And conditioned existence is painful. You have a body and mind in conditioned existence. So in a way, accept that, as it were. Don't get impatient or resentful or frustrated or despairing. Think of the suffering of others. Practice the Tonglen practice. So accept bad fortune, as it were, with an equal mind. Accept good fortune. So if things are going well, that's great. That's really, really good. But don't allow yourself to become too elated or intoxicated or ebullient. In that way, often we kind of lose contact with other people, don't we? We get so intoxicated with our own good fortune. We can get a little complacent and a little less compassionate towards others. So if things are going well, you practice Tonglen, you dedicate the merits, you breathe out. You can see that Tonglen is the central method of the mind training. You can do it in any circumstances. So accept good and bad fortune with an equal mind. Practice equanimity and patience. Number 5, keep your vows even at the risk of your life. So this is very similar to one of the pledges that we talked about last week. Keep all your vows and precepts, the ones that you've already taken. They don't need to be superseded by the mind training precepts. You add the mind training precepts to them. And we also talked last week about, you know, keeping vows at the risk of your life. It's quite a strong thing to say. And it means that these precepts are taken very seriously. We don't know what's going to befall us. We don't know whether we might find ourselves, you know, in a dreadful choice between life, death, and keeping our precepts or keeping our values. We don't know what we do in that situation. Well, you might have been in that situation. All we can do really is practice wholeheartedly and hope that this stands us in good stead. So the next set of precepts, 6 to 9, are 3 sets of 3s. And again, it's ground that we've covered already. It's a reminder. So number 6, practice the 3 austerities, or learn the 3 difficult points, or master the 3 hardships, or train yourself in the 3 hardships. So this is to do with working on mental hindrances, poisons, kleshas. And I suppose it's called 3 austerities, or difficulties, or hardships, because it's quite difficult to work with our kleshas, our poisons, our hindrances, our obstacles. So the first point, the first of these 3 in point 6, the 3 austerities, is to practice mindfulness so that you can recognise your neurotic tendencies as soon as they arise. I mean, we've talked about this before. We had the lovely image of the pig. The Tibetan saying, tap the pig on the nose. As a pig puts its snout into your kitchen, you just tap it on the nose so it doesn't get into your kitchen, because once a big, big pig is in your kitchen, it's a big, big difficulty trying to get it out of your kitchen. The other less animal-centred so if you're worried about tapping a pig on the nose, clean the lamp while it's warm. So clean the wick of the lamp while it's warm. Both these things mean you just act quickly, because you don't want so-called neurotic tendencies or poisons or kleshas or hindrances or obstacles to get hold of you. Once something's got hold of you, once you've identified with it, it takes you over. You know, that happens very, very quickly. And we're kind of lost in it, and we act out of that. So it's very important to act quickly. You don't want particularly anything to do with hatred getting hold of you. But any kind of affliction or hindrance, it's going to bring you pain and perhaps bring pain to other people. So you've got to stay on the case. This is what this point is about. So first of all, you need to recognise what's happening as soon as it arises, so you don't let it get hold of you. The second austerity is to then work with whatever arises in whatever way you can. So there's lots and lots of antidotes for hindrances and poisons and difficulties, lots of methods that we can use. But you have to know them, and you have to be able to use them quite quickly. So you know the sort of thing, cultivate the opposite, think about the consequences of letting that mental state go, just let it go into the clear blue sky, those kind of antidotes. And lastly, and this is a more kind of wisdom approach, transcend them so that they never arise again. So this is what you're really trying to do. First, you're trying to recognise, you're trying to work with, but eventually you're trying to cut through the hindrance, the difficulty, the klesha. You're trying to see, actually, that it doesn't really exist. It's a kind of mental projection. It arises in dependence on conditions. It's not really real, as it were. So if you can see that, if you can cut right through it, if you can kind of, you know, with a weed, you have to cut it, don't you? Uproot it so it doesn't kind of flower again. So this is the last thing you're trying to do with your hindrances. You're trying to cut through them so they don't arise again. So you're trying to sort of look, in a way, you're trying to look right into the hindrance and see what its nature is. And its nature is that it doesn't, in a way, it doesn't really exist. So yes, practice the three austerities. Work with your hindrances, your poisons. Stay on the case. Don't let them get hold of you. So number seven, another set of three. Take up the three primary resources that help you to practice. So these are find a teacher, devote yourself to practice, and choose a lifestyle or create good conditions. So find a teacher. Now, one could give a whole talk on finding a teacher, a whole series of talks on finding a teacher. There's a lot of texts which deal with this in Buddhism, how to look for a teacher, what kind of qualities to look for, what kind of qualities the teacher needs to look for in the disciple, what the relationship is, and so on. But it's felt to be very, very important to be in personal connection with other people more experienced than yourself who can help you grow. So someone you can be in contact with who can encourage and inspire you. Someone who can teach the Dharma relevant to you in the conditions you find yourself in. So I think it's interesting in the Dual Ornament of Liberation, a text by Gampopa, in the chapter on spiritual friendship, he outlines four kinds of spiritual friend, which he calls one, the ordinary human being, two, a bodhisattva on a high level of spiritual attainment, three, a Nirmanakaya form of the Buddha, and four, a Sambhogakaya form of the Buddha. And he says, should you ask who among these four is our greatest benefactor, the reply is that in the beginning of our career, when we are still living imprisoned by our deeds and emotions, we will not even see so much as the face of a superior spiritual friend. Instead, we will have to seek an ordinary human being who can illumine the path we have to follow with the light of his or her counsel. Therefore, the greatest benefactor is a spiritual friend in the form of an ordinary human being. That's very comforting, I think, because we're surrounded by spiritual friends in the form of ordinary human beings. I think it's very interesting in our movement, in the Friends, that there's such a strong emphasis on Sangha, on spiritual friendship, on a network of friendship. So it's not as everybody's directed towards the teacher. Some movements work more like that. But Sangha actually has developed something where Sangha is very, very important. So yes, he's the founder. He's given us some wonderful teachings. They're a resource for us, but he's also created something where we can always be in connection with other people who are practicing, some on our own levels, our peers, our friends, some, you know, a bit more experienced than us, some with maybe a lot more experience than us. We can have Kalyana Mitras at some point. We can have preceptors. So we're part of a network of friends. So he's developed something, I think, very good, a framework for practice, which we can kind of draw on as a resource. So find a teacher or find a spiritual community or put yourself in conditions that help you to practice in relationship with others on all kinds of, have all kinds of different kinds of experience that they can share with you. So find a teacher in that sense. Devote yourself to practice. So once you've found a teacher and a sangha, then take whatever the teachings are that come your way and put them into practice. You have to do that. You have to put them into practice. You have to train your mind. You have to take responsibility for that. Only you can do that in a way. In the end, you can have all kinds of help, but you have to work on yourself. So devote yourself to practice. choose a lifestyle. So this is create favourable conditions. So you have a teacher or a sangha, you're engaged with your practice and you want to create good conditions. So I think good conditions, a good basis, is very, very important. And you know, we've talked about earlier on the precious human birth with all its resources and freedoms. So conditions are interesting. Setting up good conditions is interesting, isn't it? Because we change and conditions change. So we need to review our conditions. You might set up a particular set of conditions, and that may work in a way for quite a long time. But then something happens, and you know, we're different, have different needs. We might need to change our conditions. So they're not fixed in stone. We just need to keep looking and see what are supportive conditions for us. And we need a certain amount of external supportive conditions. We need enough money, clothes, shelter, food, friendship, right livelihood. And we need inner conditions, faith, intelligence, energy for the Dharma. So do what you can in setting up conditions that work for you and appreciate your conditions. And if you have good conditions, we'll try and share those with others, or try and make good conditions available for others. That's part of the Bodhisattva ideal. If you don't have good conditions at the moment, well, don't despair. Think of others who also don't have good conditions. So many people in the world, you know, really don't have good conditions to practice the Dharma, and you wish that they did, and you practice Tonglen. So there's no reason to get despondent ever in the mind training. You can always practice Tonglen. So those are three very important resources: teacher or spiritual friends, enthusiasm for practice, and good conditions. And the eighth point says, don't allow these three things to weaken or waver. So you have them, you found them, and then it's so easy to take things for granted or to get passive or to let things go. So the three points under this one says, love your teacher, enjoy your practice, maintain your conditions. So love your teacher, or maintain respect, devotion, gratitude, faith, reverence. Just stay open. Stay open to your spiritual friends. Stay open to communication. People aren't perfect. We know that. People aren't perfect. You're not perfect. I'm not perfect. So sometimes we want perfection from people, don't we? Particularly if we have some idea about spiritual development, you know, how people should be. We're not perfect. So accept that, you know, we're not perfect. None of us are perfect. But nevertheless, you know, be open in communication, loving kindness and empathy to the people you share your spiritual life with. Don't close down, don't become cynical, don't shut off. Work with whatever happens, practice Tonglen. So love your teacher. Enjoy your practice, keep it up with enthusiasm. So you've found a practice you're devoted to, or don't let that fall away. If some kind of practice gets dry on you, or try and find out why that is. You know, there's all kinds of methods and practices and sutras and teachings. You know, there's ways of people can help you get back in touch with your inspiration, go on a retreat, maybe you haven't been on a retreat for a long time. Make sure you stay in touch with your sources of inspiration. Very, very important. And maintain your conditions. If you've got good conditions, well, try and maintain them. And the last of the set of three, point number nine, keep the three inseparables. So it just means focus your body, speech and mind on the path. So make a total commitment to practice. In some ways with these precepts, you know, there's not a great deal to say about them. They're repeating things we've already said, and you know, in a way they're quite sort of, some of them are quite obvious, I suppose. They're kind of reminders of what we should be doing. So point number 10, precept number 10, train wholeheartedly without partiality. So it's again, it's similar to previous slogans. So be committed, be wholehearted, practice with nothing held back or as little held back as possible. Practice with as much of your depth, the depths of your being as possible. Be wholehearted. Precept 11, always meditate upon what you resent. Always meditate upon what makes you boil. Always meditate on volatile points. So this is quite similar, isn't it, to one that said, work with the greatest hindrance first. We talked about that in a previous talk. This is particularly associated with, I suppose, anger, what you resent, what makes you boil, your volatile points. Always meditate on those. So again, it's related to, well, as soon as something arises, you need to be on the case. So what makes you boil? What makes you angry? What makes you go ballistic? What's your flashpoint? And sometimes it can be something quite little, and before you know it, you've lost it, as it were. And in that losing of it, if you act that out in any way, well, you may have done something that you has hurt somebody else, or you're really going to regret, or you've said something, you know, and these things can happen, can't they? Just like that. So know what they are. This is about self-knowledge. Know what kind of sets you off. Know what really kind of flips you out, as it were. And try and be aware of it. Don't back off of it, as it were, in the sense of trying to deny it. Don't give in to it, but, you know, try and engage with it as courageously as possible. Meditate upon it. You know, reflect upon it when it's not actually happening. You know something about, you know what kind of makes you angry, so what is that about? Kind of go into it. One way of working with the hindrance is to really go into the content of the hindrance. Sometimes you don't need to go into the content of things, but sometimes it's quite helpful. If something's very habitual, you get very resentful about something, or resentment's one of your hindrances, well, you know, what is that about? You really look into the nature of that hindrance, into the content. You try and get right down underneath it. So you work with it very creatively. So you don't want to boil over, you don't want to go ballistic, because it could land you in quite a lot of trouble. And I remember reading an article some years ago, and it's quite relevant today, I think, but I read it in a Sunday supplement. It was about people doing life for murder. And these are people, and I think they were mainly young men, unfortunately, and they hadn't gone out, they hadn't eaten their breakfast that day and thought, I'm going to go out and kill somebody. They'd just eaten their breakfast and gone into their day. They were young, they went to certain places, you know, maybe there was alcohol, there was a fight, you know, they got into a fight, they had that propensity for anger, to flashpoint, and, you know, there was a fight and somebody's dead, and they're in prison for life, for murder. And it just really struck me, you know, quite how sort of tragic that was, and how kind of it wasn't necessarily intended, but it's to do with, you know, a propensity in one that one hasn't totally eradicated. And well, we've all got that propensity to anger, resentment, and so on. So we need to be careful with that. And I think, well, these days, you know, we just think about London in the last couple of years and the number of gun crimes and knife crimes. In a way, if you've got a weapon, if you've got a gun or a knife, you know, it's much more likely that there will be a tragic end to something that goes on. I mean, some of those people may have intended violence, but I suppose many of them actually didn't. They just got caught up in a particular circumstance and they got angry. And they've got a weapon. So yes, we may think, well, that's not us and that's going to happen to us. But we need to know what our flashpoint is, you know, what we boil over, what really gets us going, what's really going to be out of our control so that we're going to behave very unskillfully and cause pain to others. So know what that is, meditate upon it, reflect upon it, work with it. Don't deny it, don't kind of shove it away. I never get angry, I'm a nice Buddhist. Yes, okay. So the next one is really interesting in relation to one we've just already had. Precept number 12 says, don't depend on external conditions. Don't depend on external conditions. So I think having supportive conditions, is good. It's good to set up supportive conditions. And again, in that first point, the precious human birth, you know, we set up conditions, we appreciate the conditions we have, we appreciate the resources and the freedoms, and we really use those as a basis for practice. But here we're being asked not to be dependent on those conditions. Well, I suppose conditions can change. You can set up wonderful conditions and who knows what's going to happen, you know, tomorrow. We can just lose them. So while you've got them, use them, but don't be totally dependent upon them. Sometimes this is, commentators say, this also means don't be swayed by external conditions in terms of how the world is. Just because the world is a certain way, there's certain things happening in the world, you don't have to join in that, as it were. I think the main point about this is the practice of mind training does not need special conditions. You can live anywhere, you can live in any conditions, you can be poor, you can be old, you can be sick, you can even be dying or not. You can be right in the middle of a busy life rather than on solitude or on retreat. It's a practice of mind training because it's got this emphasis on taking adversity onto the path, taking difficulties onto the path, and the method of Tonglen. It's a practice for all conditions, all seasons of life, whatever's happening. So in a way, even the absence of good conditions in the mind training is a resource. It's a resource that you can use. So by not relying on favourable conditions, that makes the mind training an extraordinary condition. So you don't need special conditions. If you've got them, that's great. If you've got good conditions, you dedicate that to all sentient beings, you breathe those out to all sentient beings. If you've got difficult conditions, you breathe that in, you think about all other beings who have difficult conditions, who don't have good conditions. So this is a mark of training, probably, isn't it, of a mind trainer, that you know you can practice wherever you are, whatever you're doing, whatever's going on. You remember Tonglen, you remember, you can take adversities onto them. Even if you just remember that, even if it's really difficult to do it, which it is, at least you've got that in mind. You know, you're practicing the mind training. So again, it's a training without any breaks. 13. Practice what is most central, what is most meaningful, what is most important right now. Practice what matters. Practice the two bodhicittas that are in the centre of your mandala. Practice that, practice Tonglen, practice taking adversity onto the path. Don't make mistakes. I think it's fine to make mistakes, really. We learn from our mistakes, don't we? It's also said, don't let emotions distract you. So this is often given 6 sub-points. So it's you think you're practicing and actually you're not, which often happens, doesn't it? So you can have mistaken patience. So you can be patient with things that don't really matter, but you're not patient with the hardships of the Dharma. You can have mistaken inclination. So you have an inclination for wealth and pleasure and comfort rather than the practice of the Dharma. You can have mistaken enjoyment. So you can look for enjoyment and entertainment in lesser matters rather than looking for joy in the Dharma. You can have mistaken compassion. So you have compassion for nice people, people who are kind to you, but not for difficult people, who are, of course, the people who need your compassion. You can have mistaken care, where we befriend others who think can help us, rather than those who are really serious practitioners in the Dharma. And we have mistaken joy. So we have joy in others' unhappiness, rather than joy at the good that people do. So it's just pointing to, you know, you really need to know what it is you're trying to develop and make sure you're not falling short of that. 15. Don't be erratic, don't fluctuate, don't let your practice be irregular. I'm sure we've touched on this before, it's not new. So remember those 5 forces from point number 4, that constant application to practice, moment by moment, day by day, working with the law of karma in terms of habitual karma, accumulating merit. So sometimes it's easy to practice, isn't it, when you're on retreat, you're in good supportive conditions, but then it's not so easy to keep going once you're not in those conditions. Or, you know, we set up a good regular meditation practice and then something happens, we get a bit poorly or something just, I don't know, something changes in our life and we let it go. And I did quote from Dhyana for Beginners earlier on about the quote about making fire. You know, if you're out in the wilds with your 2 sticks and you've got no matches and no lighter, you're trying to make fire, you have to rub those 2 sticks together for a very long time. You have to keep at it if you're going to make fire. So that's the image that's used for practice in that text. And I saw a program recently on the television. I'm sure others of you saw it. It was about meditation and science. Anybody see that program? So it was scientists trying to see if meditation had any effect on the brain. So there's lots of interest in brain and consciousness. And interestingly enough, they discovered, the scientists, that people who consistently and regularly, daily, for half an hour or more, practice meditation over a reasonable period of time, I can't remember how many years it was, showed change in brain structure. Well, we know that intuitively, don't we? We know that that happens. If you're practicing a long time, you know that your emotions change. But actually, they could measure it. Whatever is the emotional centre of the brain, in those people who meditated. And the point was made, it had to be consistent, regular, over a period of time. That part of their brain had changed, and presumably changed for good, maybe. So towards positive emotions. So that's interesting, isn't it? 10, 5, 1. Well, I've got Latin numerals. 16. Train wholeheartedly. Don't need to comment on that one. 17. Liberate yourself by analysing and examining. So again, know your own mind. Know your own mind with compassionate and fearless honesty. Liberate yourself from the clashes through awareness, so identifying what goes on in your mind and overcoming them or letting them just disappear into the clear blue sky. 18. Don't feel sorry for yourself. It's interesting why they come up when they do these. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Don't wallow in self-pity. Sometimes this one's called don't make a fuss. Don't be oversensitive. So I suppose, yeah, spiritual practice can be challenging, can't it, and difficult. And sometimes we think, oh, we're not up to it, can't do it. You know, everybody else can do it, I can't do it, I'm so hopeless. So you can fall into that sort of self-pity. If you come to Atala's weekend, Psyche and Amor, Psyche was like that, wasn't she? I can't do it. You know? And then the ants would come, or whatever would come and help her. But anyway, yes, I can't do it, I'm going to throw myself off a cliff. So we can fall into that kind of despair. I mean, I'm parodying, but it actually can feel very painful, can't it, when you feel like that. So yes, don't fall into self-pity. You can always take that emotion. Okay, I'm feeling like that, I'm feeling self-pity, I haven't got much confidence in myself. What do you do with that? You practice Tonglen for yourself. 19? Yes, 19. Don't be jealous. Don't be caught in retaliation. So again, I think it's similar to previous precepts. The Bodhisattva does not respond to abuse with abuse, to blows with blows, to any kind of violence with violence. One of the Bodhisattva precepts. But here it says don't be jealous. That's quite interesting, isn't it? Because jealousy and envy can be very, very strong emotions. That can be a flashpoint for us, can't it? That can be one of the emotions that kind of gets us going, as it were. It can be very, very painful. So jealousy, you're suspicious or fearful of being displaced by a rival. So often jealousy takes place within close relationships, often the sexual relationship. We're very strong in that area of life. Very, very painful, very difficult. And you know, we feel we've lost something and we want it back and we want to kill the rival and we want vengeance, you know, we want revenge, all those kind of feelings arise. Envy, I think, is often said to be you have a grudging or even admiring discontent about the possession of an achievement or a quality of someone else. So they have got some kind of achievement or quality that you wish you had. So I suppose they both come from a sense of lack in yourself, a feeling of lack in yourself, something you don't have. Yeah, so very strong emotion. So it goes, don't be jealous, don't be caught in retaliation. Again, if you experience those feelings, don't necessarily deny them, but experience them, meditate upon them, and practice Tonglen. 20. Stay focused, don't be temperamental, fickle or impulsive, don't get caught up in irritation. That's obvious, isn't it? 21. Last one. Don't expect gratitude, applause or thanks. Oh, isn't that awful, right at the end? Isn't that terrible? You know, 7-point mind training, 7 weeks, 59 points. You know, you got your way through all of that and then you're told, don't expect any gratitude, applause or thanks for putting all of that into practice. Don't boast. This goes back to things that say don't boast. Stay natural, bring about a change in yourself, but stay natural. Have a pure intention in your practice. So yes, obviously you're not trying to appropriate the mind training to your ego clinging. You're trying to undercut ego clinging. So yes, don't expect gratitude, applause or thanks. Keep a low profile, as it were. So you're not practicing the mind training for any kind of gain, any personal gain, but you're practicing to develop that mind of emptiness and compassion for all living beings. Oh well. So that is the end of our exploration of the mind training teachings. I hope you found them helpful and relevant to you in your life and practice. So there's many modern commentaries on the mind training teachings if you want to pursue it yourself in your own time. There are books by, they're probably in the bookshop, in the library, Alan Wallace, Chogyam Trungpa, Pema Chodron, Geshe Rabton. So lots and lots of commentaries on the mind training that you can read. And most of those will be based on some of the commentaries of the great earlier teachers like Tsongkhapa, great Tibetan teacher, Jamyon Khonchon, Dilgo Khenpo Khonchon. So look those up if you wish. If you want some background reading, apart from specific commentaries on mind training, I would suggest Sangharakshita's book on the Bodhisattva ideal, which will give you the whole kind of framework of the Bodhisattva ideal. Wonderful book. And I would recommend his chapter on karma in Who is the Buddha, because an understanding of karma underpins the mind training methods. I mean, underpins dharmic methods, but particularly mind training reflections. A deeper understanding of karma would be very, very helpful. So I just want to conclude by recapping a little bit, just to sort of see what we've covered in the past 7 weeks, quite briefly. So we began by reflecting on those four mind turnings, training the preliminaries, turning our minds towards the Dharma as a foundation for the rest of the practice. So I think the precious human birth reflections on you, reflecting on your freedoms and endowments and the three kinds of faith, very, very positive reflection that I would recommend that you do or add to your practice, or just remember that Perma Tsongkhapa, because it can give you a great deal of confidence. But don't get complacent, because next you meditate on death and impermanence. You realise that life is ephemeral and conditions change. The third of those reflections is on actions and consequences, which is obviously very, very important, that you see what consequences come from what actions, and then the nature of conditioned existence itself. So those four reflections were to turn our minds towards the Dharma. And if you remember that phrase, having gained stability, reveal the mystery. So the second point was we turn to the main, the heart of the mind training, reflections and aphorisms to develop the two bodhicittas, ultimate and relative. And then we leaned into difficulties. We learned to take difficulties onto the path, a special emphasis of the mind training teaching, supported by the practice of Tonglen. Then we supported all that by trying to practice the five powers: determination, familiarization, accumulation of merit, purification, and aspiration, moment by moment in life, and having those five powers at death. Then we took a moment to evaluate our progress and to understand that the central purpose of the mind training is to uproot selfishness and clear the way for the development of bodhicitta. And then finally, we've taken commitments, pledges and promises and precepts to develop and maintain mind training. So the main purpose of the mind training is to transform our attitudes towards others, to learn to care for them as much as or even more than ourself, the exchange of self and others. So that's the main purpose. We're trying to learn to turn adversity into advantage. We're trying to see that the real enemy is disturbing emotions arising from ego clinging and not others as the cause of our difficulties. And we're also trying to change our view of reality, seeing all phenomena as an illusion. So I'd like to finally conclude. I'm going to read Atisha's seven short verses with his preceding homage and his conclusion. And then I'm going to read Chikawa's dedication at the end of his 57 points. I bow to the spiritual friends of the Supreme Vehicle, source of everything good in samsara and nirvana. By the gracious Lama's blessings, may my mind be purified with the three kinds of faith. By the gracious Lama's blessings, knowing how hard to obtain and how easy destroyed is this precious human life, in all my actions, according to their karmic effect, may I try to do what is right and avoid what is wrong, and develop a genuine determination to be free from samsara as I train in the preliminaries. By the gracious Lama's blessings, may I purify the untruth of duality into the space of voidness and practice the profound exchange of my own and others' happiness and suffering, meditating continually on the two aspects of bodhicitta. By the gracious Lama's blessings, may I condense my lifetime's practice into a single essence by applying throughout my life the five powers of pure determination, pure practice, accumulation of merit, purification of obscurations, and prayers of aspiration. By the gracious Lama's blessings, when everything arises as the antidote to ego clinging, and my mind finds freedom with happiness and confidence, may I take all adverse circumstances as the path. By the gracious Lama's blessings, may I keep my promises, be free of hypocrisy, have no partiality and little outward show, protecting the commitments of the mind training as I would my own life. In essence, by the gracious Lama's blessings, may I genuinely train in my mind according to all the precepts, which further the two aspects of bodhicitta and attain realization of the supreme vehicle within this very lifetime. By the merit of this heartfelt aspiration to practice the seven-point mind training, essence of the minds of the peerless Lord and his disciples, may all beings accomplish enlightenment. And Chikawa's dedication. When the five dark ages occur, this is the way to transform them into Bodhi. This is the essence of the Amrita of the oral instructions, which were handed down from the tradition of the sage of Suvarnadipa. Having awakened the karma of previous training and being urged on by intense dedication, I disregarded misfortune and slander and received oral instruction on taming ego fixation. Now, even at death, I will have no regrets.